Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast, RPG Site's weekly podcast. I'm your host, Brian Vitale. Joining me, we have Josh Torres.
Valve loves me, actually.
Adam Vitale.
Hello.
James Galizio.
Hey, folks.
And Mikhail Menani.
Hello.
Yeah, no child this week. He's got a real-life lunch date of some sort. Invited out for lunch. Could be anything. So we'll catch up with him next week. But yeah, we're here recording in the middle of May. I'm looking at our podcast outline and a little bit of a lighter stretch of news this week. We have some big releases coming out at the end of the month. We're a few days away from the official release of Mina the Hollower. We've got Zero Parades. There's Endless Ragnarok coming up within a month. Is that within a month? About a month.
I think it's early July, so not quite a month.
Oh, I'm ahead. All right. Well, that's still on the docket for the future. But yeah, looking at this week, a little bit of a lighter slate, but we do have a few things to talk about. We'll have one game that Embargo just lifted on that we can talk about. Another game that released a couple months ago that has had good words of mouth that we'll talk about as well. We're going to be talking about Starbites, and I'm going to look back at Esoteric Ebb as kind of like game two. And then we'll go into some news, a few trailers, some upcoming games. We have a couple features from Mikhail that are really interesting and neat that we'll definitely take a look at. So we'll just kind of play it by ear and go through it like that, but a little bit of a lighter slate. So we'll just kind of go with what we got and see where it takes us. So without further ado, we'll just start out with a review that Josh has put up for this week for Starbites. So Starbites, I remember seeing this game when it was announced and through its early media cycle, but I'm kind of foggy on some of the details about what it was and who was making it. So just tee us up on what Starbites is, and then you can kind of go into like your thoughts on the game and what you wrote up for it and, you know, all that good stuff.
Yeah. The Starbites is developed by Korean studio Ikina Games, and they've released several smaller scope titles before. The titles escaped me real fast. Let me go check on Steam what their developer stuff is. Yeah, they have All of Us Are Dead, The Ramsey, Super Hamster Ball. They've been around since like, I think like mid-90s, like 1995, I believe, I remember from the interview that I did with them last PAX West. So, and Starbites is a turn-based RPG that was announced some while ago. At first, they didn't announce it with a publisher. Then, eventually, they partnered with Nice America to release this in the West. And I believe it released in Japan like late last year or something. I don't know if they self-published that or not. But yeah, Starbites is a pretty interesting, like, smaller scope title. Compared to their past games, is clearly like their, you know, most ambitious title yet, but way more bigger scope than the other games that they've developed over the years. And it's okay. It's pretty neat. Like, there's definitely some things I don't like about it, but overall, it was like I described it as a simple yet solid RPG. It focuses around this salvager named Lukita on this desert planet of Bitter. And Bitter is sort of in a rough state. It's a desert planet. It's kind of got, it's like almost a post-apocalyptic feel where there's like some big war in the past that has drastically affected like environmental conditions on that planet. So most of it is barren. And Lukita's story centers around, hey, I want to get off this planet. She lives in this town called Delight, and she kind of gets exploited by its overseer named Fennec. It just seems like whenever, you know, Lukita has like some sort of financial debt to Fennec that she pretty much can't pay off. It's too, whatever the amount is exactly, it's too much that there's no feasible way that she'd be able to pay off her debt.
It's a predatory student loan.
Yeah, pretty much. And the beginning of the game starts with, you know, she's finally like saved up for this ticket to get off of Bitter. It's like, you know, I assume like some sort of like starship takes this ticket, and then you can, you know, get a ride off of Bitter. And you know, she's telling her friends Gwendol and Badger about it. Shortly thereafter that, she gets attacked by this like mysterious mech, and there's like one of those, like, you know, unbeatable boss battles at the beginning of the game. You get wiped out, and she wakes up back at the light with her ticket missing. So a good chunk of like the first third of that game centers around this story of like, hey, where's my ticket? What happened to it? Who took it? And kind of on this wild goose chase on like where this ticket. But that's not the entirety of the story, and I'm glad that like it. At first, I thought it was just gonna be like this wild goose chase for the entire game. Like, oh, is this just gonna be like, hey, where's my, you know, where did my ticket go? But it, at a certain point, you find out exactly where it is after searching its several places, and you find out who took it. You get it back. Something happens, and the scope of the game sort of shifts in a way where you still have this goal of getting Alpha Bitter, but there are certain narrative elements that come to the fore that really change up the direction of this plot, and I think in a pretty interesting way. Obviously, I won't spoil anything, and I won't say it's not like anything revelatory or something you've never seen in a video game story before, but I do appreciate the way that they go about it. It is very much a game that transforms into, you know, the sins of our past generation type deal, and what do we do to move forward from that. The game system itself is, I think the strongest part about the Star Bites is its gameplay, like the gameplay loop of itself, where you have an interesting combat system complemented by like a pretty engaging character progression system. So the combat system is at first like very reminiscent of a little bit of Octopath Traveler and a little bit of like early Trails games, where underneath the health bar of enemies, you have those blank slots like an Octopath Traveler, and you have to find out what you know, which attributes are their weaknesses. So in this game, you have like attributes like cut, thermal, plasma, etc. And as you uncover those weak points and hit them, you are decreasing the shield value like an Octopath Traveler. And if you deplete that shield value, you'll get the enemy to break state, and it'll push their turn farther back in the turn order timeline. And during this break state, you know, they take more damage, such. Very, very, like, you know, if you've played Octopath Traveler before, that's pretty easy to understand. Each of your characters has, obviously, their HP bar, their SP bar for skills, and this gauge called Driver's High. And as you're normally, when you're like attacking and taking damage, this driver's high gauge will increase. When that's full for a character, you can activate it at any time, whether it's another person's turn or an enemy's turn, and that character can act immediately right then and there. And so it's kind of like that interrupt system, like in Trails, like you had like
an S-craft
filled up. Yeah, exactly. And during this driver's high like turn, the obviously your tools are buffed, but also they can change the state of your skills depending on how you've upgraded skills on your skill tree. Like for example, a driver's high version of a skill might either change its attribute or add on more attributes that it does. It might amplify like the buff effect of a skill. Like for example, there's a character that has like a AoE defense buff that they can do, but if you use this skill in Driver's High, it'll actually grant an invincible state to your character, so they can like soak up one any sorts of damage for that like one turn that take it on that. So that's just like one small example of what a driver's high buff can do for a skill. And it's kind of interesting because they play around with this a lot in the combat system, where some characters might learn skills that distribute drivers' high gauge at the expense of their own. So, you know, like Lakita gets the skill where it'll deplete her entire driver's high gauge to distribute it to your other party members. So up to three party members can participate in battle. So there's, you know, if you want to go that route of like of building up your party, you could actually have a character provide a support to allow characters to get into this driver's high status more frequently. You can also have them, you know, also be a support. You can also have them be specialized in like single or AoE damage or and hitting attributes in that way. And it's also interesting because the formation of the enemies in these combat encounters matter a lot in terms of usually in other RPGs, you have enemies that are right by each other in a single line, like in a single row, in turn-based battles. In this game, it's the position of them in that row is kind of matters. So what I mean by that is sometimes instead of like 4 to 5 enemies lined up together in a row, sometimes it'll be sectioned off. Like there'll be 2 enemies and then like a gap and then another 2 enemies on that gap. So that means that your AoE skills can't hit all those enemies at once. They will only hit that cluster. So you have to, they kind of start throwing you enemy mobs that cannot be hit all at once or you can't hit all their attribute weaknesses. Sometimes it'll be like 3 single enemies all separated from one another. So your AoE skills don't really matter much in that. So you have to start thinking about, okay, what are some hard hitting, like single, skills that I have? Does this skill have a multi-hit on it so I can break this enemy before they take a turn? Sometimes they have high shield value. Should I prioritize, you know, trying to stun this enemy instead of trying to break them instead? So at least even though I can't break them, it'll still, you know, they still can't act, but I'm gambling on this stun ailment proccing.
It kind of sounds a little Dragon Quest-ish, only without the requirement that it's the same type of enemy. In Dragon Quest, if it's the same type of enemy, they can kind of be clustered up in like to the left or right of the row, but only if they share a type.
Right. Yeah. The very similar in that aspect too. And you know, this game is fine with like clustering up like different types of enemies together. So right. Like you'll have like, you know, Robot A, Robot B. They don't share weakness attributes, but they're clustered together. So it's like, okay, how do I, you know, mitigate the incoming enemy turns on this? And sometimes, you know, my answer is like, hey, I'm going to buff my party members because I have like this really, you know, good defense buff that'll definitely cut down on the damage I'm going to take from the. And the skill trees of like each of your characters is pretty cool because all of them have like, I guess the best way to put it is usually they have 3 trees per tier. So you have like the beginner tier, and like the first tree in that tier is like the it'll branch off and have different properties that you can enhance for either offensive skill A or offensive skill B. Then you have the middle tree in that beginner tier that branches off into like how do you want to increase like the recovery potential of like this character's like recovery skill. Do you want them to like one tree will be like, I'm gonna enhance like, you know, how much HP I'm getting out of this skill, and the other tree is like decreasing cost plus it might like add like a small defense buff to that skill. And then the other third tree enhances like the driver's high state of the skills in your kit. And you can distribute your points because you gain 1 skill point per level up. And you can distribute them however you want. And it's a free respec, so at any time. So let's say like I'm not really feeling like that I invested my skill points down this tree. I'll just refund all my skill points and try another build. And after you spend like 10 skill points in that beginner tier, it'll unlock like the veteran or like the intermediate tier of that. And you'll have new skills that you learn from leveling up, and so you can upgrade them in different ways. They also might have like support skills that you've gained that you might want to enhance. And then you have the driver's high tree that affects those skills that you unlocked as well. And once again, there's all, you know, you can really play around with how you want to build your characters, because there's like, you won't have enough skill points to like make everything good. You have to think about like, okay, what skills do I want each character to really focus on, and do those skills synergize with one another in this party formation? And that's kind of what really is the nice thing about this game, is it really encourages experimentation, and really encourages like smart party formation in that respect, on what you want to focus on in battles, because this becomes important, because especially later down in the game, you'll have big boss battles that are just start introducing sort of like puzzle-esque mechanics in it, where, for example, like this boss might have like a ridiculously high like shield value that it will regenerate per turn, and once you break it, you have to I won't really spoil the mechanic in this, but something happens if you break it in this boss battle. So there's a reason why it keeps regenerating shields. So how do you navigate that kind of boss battle? Stuff like that. And that eventually you'll get like a full party of six. Only three can be out as your battle members. So the other three who aren't in battle, they'll still get experience at a reduced rate, but you can also set them as a support member for one of the frontliners. So when that frontliner character breaks an enemy, they'll come in and like do like a pretty powerful like follow-up attack as well. And the properties of like what they do in that support attack changes. So one of the characters has like a mech that looks like something from Mech Warrior, so it has like missile pods strapped onto its shoulders. And the support attack can be like one of three, maybe four different attacks, and one of those might like do AoE. One of those might be like super high single target damage. It's you don't have any control over like what support attack they use. They kind of just come in and they do one of those like three or four support attacks. But it's one of those things that you calculate of like, okay, I know this character does real like has high support damage, so I should probably put them on a character that can reliably break enemies frequently, so they have more of a chance to come in and do their support attack. Stuff like that, just things that you calculate in the back of your mind over all this, as you're getting a full scope of like what you want your like end game party formation to be. And that's kind of
everything you're describing this game. Like it's like it sounds like it's a game that has like good bones, or whatever you call it, like a good framework. Like the story you mentioned, at least like the premise about I forget the protagonist's name,
Lakita,
being stuck in like a debt cycle that she can't get out of, finally gets her ticket out of there, like a physical item, but also like what it represents, right? You know, mm-hmm. freedom or whatever.
Right.
Talking about the break system reminiscent of Octopath, the tiered skills, the follow-up attacks of reserve party members, like everything, like nothing is, you know, completely novel, but it sounds like, yeah, that sounds like a good framework for a game. Like, you know, could make a decent RPG out of those like piece parts, out of those components.
Yeah. The aspect of it, I really like. Everything else is like, it's okay. Nothing I'd say is like downright awful, but sort of like, it sucks that like, you know, like I kind of get why they're like the development team is trying their best. But I think one of the things that really, you know, holds this game back, for example, is like there's a lot of backtracking in this game, both in its main story and its side quests. Like you'll at a certain point, you'll start seeing some of the gears behind this game, where usually you'll have an objective that you go out this is not an open world game. There's like segmented zones, maps that you're traveling across. But, you know, usually as you're traversing through this main story and side quest, you'll go to, like, a dungeon area. You go into that dungeon area, and then you'll eventually fight a boss in it. But after you're done with that story beat, sometimes you'll pick up, like, a side quest, for example, and they want you to go back out there, like, not exactly into the dungeon, but like by the dungeon entrance, because they have a fetch quest for you. And the fast traveling system in this game is very, it's relatively restrictive than like most other games these days, where the fast travel hubs are usually the towns. So it's like Delight, and the, like the hideout that you have at the beginning of the game, and some other places, but it's like maybe 4 to 5 at most, like fast traveling hubs, with the towns. So like if you get this fetch quest to go back out and investigate this area by the dungeon entrance where you just were, you have to manually go back out there and traverse through those zones again, to go do that fetch quest side quest. There's no easy way to like immediately fast travel. Sure, like it's easy enough to like avoid enemies on the way there. It's not like the biggest, it's not a big time commitment, but it's just like you're retracing your steps almost exactly after you just did it, in that regard. And that happens multiple times throughout the game. And there's no, you know, there are save point stations in those maps, but there's no fast travel terminals out on the field. You have to, that's all in the town area. And so the frequent backtracking does kind of wear on a little bit. Another thing that, you know, I'm not the biggest graphics person, so it didn't, like, it was, for me, it was easy to, you know, get used to it, but it does have this Star Ocean The Last Hope effect, where the 2D artwork and the 2D illustrations are, you know, they look great, but the 3D models, not so much. Where, you know, you might see screenshots, whether in my review or in the Steam page, where you see, like, the characters, you know, like, their portraits during, like, character changes, like, they look really good. Has, like, a really nice aesthetic to it, very pleasing. But the 3D model representation of that, you know, it's rougher when you see them both on the screen at the same time. For the 3D models themselves, like, they're okay. They remind you of, like, you know, late 90s, early aughts, like Saturday morning cartoons, when they started experimenting more with 3D CG shows on that, and it definitely has the spirit of that as you play the game.
Yeah, it does kind of look like either like a late PS2 game or like Ruby the Show, like, or in its earlier years, kind of. Mm-hmm. Like, not, that's not quite right, but I see what you're kind of getting at.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's one of those things that, like, people's mileage will vary on that, whether it bothers them or not. For me, not too much, but I get it. I actually played, even though this game defaults on Japanese voices, I actually switched it to the English voices for this one because I was curious. And the English cast is surprisingly really solid in this game. I enjoyed the English voice acting.
Oh, cool.
I was glad to, you know, I don't know what I was expecting. It's not like I come in expecting a bad English dub, but I'm just kind of curious because this release was so,
it's a lower, like, profile game.
Yeah, lower profile game, and it's sometime after the original release in Japan and all that sort of stuff. So I was like wondering, okay, let's see, like, the new stuff they added in our version. And yeah, the English acting is, like, it's pretty good all around. I really enjoyed the voice cast, English voice cast of this game. I guess other things that, like, hold this game back from really becoming really, really great is it's sort of buggy, where there are times where the game isn't as responsive as I want it to be in terms of, like, character movement. It's sort of floaty. Sometimes there'll be triggers that cause the game to behave erratically. For example, like, let's say I'm going down this path on the map, and let's say there's a path that goes to the right, that's like the main, like the way that you're supposed to go, and there's a path that goes out straight, like a small area with an enemy in a chest. For whatever reason, sometimes let's say, of course, I'm gonna go explore side paths for loot and stuff like that. If I go down that side path and I end the battle with the enemy there, sometimes it doesn't always happen. For whatever reason, it feels like that the game expected me to go down the main path. So, like, the camera when it's transitioning back out from the battle into that world, it's hovering over the area where the main story path was going to be. It has to quickly pan over to where my character is after that battle. It's like, oh, there's like, oh shit, you're over there. We totally didn't expect you to be there. So like the camera has to like readjust itself like quickly back to your location, which is like a really funny thing to observe. It's like, huh, okay. There's another, certain other bugs that like happen more often. It's like, if I went into another battle, like a few seconds after another battle, it takes like maybe a little bit longer to transition to that battle, to the point that like I sort of wondered where I was like, did my game lock up or not? It's like, no, it just took a little bit more time to load in that battle. So there might be some, you know, wonky things behind the scenes of like how it's like, you know, rendering stuff to from one battle to another. I played the PlayStation 5 version for reference on that. So obviously a game of this like visual caliber, you would expect to run a little bit better in that regard, but it does run at a smooth 60 FPS frame rate overall. And that's nothing that in terms of like FPS performance. It's just like small performance bugs like that do prop up. I think the one that made me almost concerned, but I'm glad it corrected itself, was there was this time during the main story that like I had to go talk to these NPCs at the small camp town hub, and during that character interaction, the camera, you know, obviously focused on those two NPCs chatting with my characters. But after that conversation, normally, you know, I was supposed to have like in control. I was supposed to be in control of my characters again. Obviously, the camera should have been back focused on my characters moving. For whatever reason, the camera locked up on those two NPCs as if they were still talking to my characters, but I could move my characters, but it was all off screen on that.
Oh, okay.
So I was like, okay, I can't see my characters. I don't know like what I'm supposed to do, but I need to get this camera back on my characters. So luckily, like the town hub was small enough that like I was able to talk to a character, an NPC, while my characters were off screen, and I know that character was directly right by the exit. I would just have to move back in a straight line from that NPC. So I used an off screen NPC's dialogue to know of like, okay, that's where my characters are. I'd have to move back in a straight line to outside of the town to forcefully reset the camera back to my characters because of the map transition. So that was an interesting experience on that end. So, like, you know, like, normally, like, if it hung on that, that would be a game-breaking bug if it didn't, like, fix itself there. Obviously, I'd have to, like, either reload, and if that was reproducible, that'd be a problem. You know, it's just one of those things that's, like, that can ruin a playthrough if this was, like, a more serious bug that you couldn't fix on your own.
Yeah, like it didn't affect you long term, but it easily could have.
Yeah,
you know, sort of thing.
Let's see. And you know, since your characters are all like riding their like mechs, each mech has like, you know, the usual equipment slots where, you know, they have different weapons, and then you can equip them like different upper frames, lower frames, and a subframe. It's all basically equipment that enhances your stats. Usually, like, most of the frames do change the appearance of the mechs of different armors, especially because it's segmented armor. You can definitely make like some sort of like Frankenstein monsters-esque creations because you're mixing and matching different frames on that mech to kind of obviously get beneficial stats, but also you're changing the appearance as you're swapping out their armor on that, which is fun. Sometimes it'll change the color of the mech. Sometimes it's not as robust or universal as I'd like it to be, because it's like, especially some of the later mechs that you get from the later party members, like they're sort of more rigid and stiff over like which equipment will change the appearance of their mech. Like for example, if you recruit like the fifth party member and you want to see, you know, what does this earlier equipment look like on its mech, just to like see like, you know, what it is. It's like that won't change the model of it. And even then, like some of like the later armors and frames that you get, like only some of them will change the appearance, not all of them. So I was like it's okay, it's fine that's like you even added the feature in the first place, but it's sort of as like one of those things that's like it's not as, you know, freeform as I'd like it to be, especially because you can't do like custom paint jobs on your backyard either on that end. It would have been really fun. And there's also like another equipment system outside of that, which is our engines and cores, where you get like different engines that have core slots, and these further tweak like your characters, whether you enhance their crit rate, you have them heal a certain amount of HP or SP as the battle begins. The interesting thing about this system is that there's restrictions on it, where let's say you equip this engine core that has three, or you equip this engine that supports three cores, and you have two cores on you that activate at the battle start. Let's say you have one core that recovers your HP by 30% when the battle begins, and you have another core that increases your attack by 40% as the battle begins. You cannot equip both of these cores at the same time because they have the same activation of them, of that core activating at the battle start. So that means that only one of them can be active. So to equip other cores on it, you'd have to equip cores that have different activation requirements, such as one that activates, you know, when your HP is under 40%, or one that activates when you use a basic attack. So that's an interesting, like, limiting system where you have to start thinking about, like, okay, I can't equip, like, the most ideal core set at times. You have to start messing around with, like, cores that don't override each other in terms of, like, how they're activated. Which is, I thought it was, like, an interesting, neat system to work around.
I mean, it's kind of like an indirect, like, class or category system. Like, you can only have one of this type of core, and then one of another type of core based on their activation type. On paper, that sounds perfectly fine.
It's neat. Yeah, it's a neat system. Yeah, and they also have a really fun thing where one of the side activities you can do in the game is Ikeda Games just basically put their whole full game of the Ramsey, which is like a puzzle platformer that they released several years ago. That whole game is just, you can use that. You can just go to like an arcade terminal at the light at a certain point in the game and like just play that game. You know, they just basically included that for free in the game as well, which is fun. So that's cool. You know,
that's always neat. Pretty rare, but you know, outside of like RPG Studio, they do that. It's pretty rare.
Yeah. Yeah.
With Sega stuff.
But yeah, overall, it was a better game than I thought, and I enjoyed my time with it. I think it was a really neat game. I mentioned it in the review as well, but I also just, it's weird to be nostalgic about this, but it's nice that like an RPG just comes out and there's like distinct dungeons that you go into, and there's like dungeon areas, and they have like light puzzle mechanics to it. Like one of the dungeons will be like, hey, there's like secret fake walls in it. Or one of the dungeon mechanics, like there's like colored key cards. Go find like these colored key cards if you want to move forward in it. Like there's like actual like exploration you have to do inside the dungeon if you want all the treasure and to move forward.
Yeah, like non-combat gameplay that isn't just exploring an open world.
Yeah, it's weird to be nostalgic about that. But
no, I am with you. You know, a lot of games these days are either like, they're either like battle corridors where it's just like, you know, a straight line, but you're fighting battles along it, and that's the gameplay. Or it's like open world or maybe open zone exploration, you know, where you're just wandering maps or whatever. So having actual like dungeon design with puzzles and key cards and maybe block pushing or whatever, I think it's cool.
Yeah, block pushing, ice puzzles. I'm trying to think like all the classics, like, you know, no friction here, one-way doors.
Sometimes I see people talking about like, you know, like they should re-release, you know, Golden Sun or something on modern platforms. And I'm like, I wonder what modern like RPG players would think of like Golden Sun's like dungeons, because they're very dungeony.
Oh, extremely dungeony. like, this was a while ago, but it apparently there was a big change that was made to Honkai Star Rail that changed how puzzly and how many like different things you had to worry about in dungeons, and they were like, oh, we're simplifying it.
It's like Shin Megami Tensei 5.
Yeah, like, I remember Zelda Zone Zero had like a very drastic change, or before release, and even like in the at the early release of that game, there's like a thing called TV mode in that game, where it was basically a dungeon-esque like exploration mode in that game done through like TVs. So it had like, but it was one of those things that like enough of its player base did not like that dungeon like TV mode, because they felt it was like too tedious, like, you know, it's kind of getting away from like the combat gameplay that they like, because that like the way that you interface with this mode had like none of the real-time action gameplay that that game had. So they just like stripped that mode entirely. They just got rid of TV mode, even though it was like one of those things that they worked on for a lot of years before Zelda Zone Zero came out. And sure enough, like, I don't know how long it took for them to just strip it out of the game entirely, but it's just like, man, what are we doing? So, you know, it's crazy. But yeah, if you're in the market for like a smaller scope RPG, turn-based RPG, this is a pretty solid one of those. It's not like amazing, but it's like, it'll take some time to like really get into, but you'll walk away with a fun time if you give it some time to really open up its mechanic.
And like we mentioned, Josh does have the written review for Starbites up on the site at rpgsite.net.
And I have another friend who has also played this game, kind of had a similar takeaway where, you know, kind of a smaller scoped, relatively mechanically dense RPG that is sort of old school in a way. So like Josh said, that was their takeaway of it. So it's interesting to me. Like not every game has to be like big budget, cinematic, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
yeah. It was nice.
And the second game that I have queued up here is one that I earmarked to talk about. And this is not a game I finished, but I'm about like 16, 17 hours into it. So I feel like I can speak to it at least at some decent length. And that's Esoteric Ebb. So this is a game that released back, I think it was April, earlier in the year. And it has, let me just double check that. It had really good word of mouth from both like formal, you know, written reviews, YouTube or social media posts, you know, Steam impressions.
Yeah. Before this game came out and they were advertising it, it definitely showed Disco Elysium inspirations, which is, you know, a great game to be inspired by, but it's like, can this at all, you know, even come close in arm's length of like reaching that sort of writing quality or whatever, you know? So it's kind of hard. It was kind of hard to know before it came out, is this something even worth paying attention to? But once it came out, like you said, the reception has been pretty good for it.
Yeah. So I'm not finished with this game, and it's one of those things where it's like, I like it, but, and let me try to like tee it up. So first of all, for whatever reason, it took me several tries to get into it. Like I put it on my Steam Deck. This is like my laying on the couch or in bed before falling asleep, like poke away at it in short bits, you know, game. And it, for what it's worth, it works on the Steam Deck pretty damn well. But every time I would start it up, I would like get 15 minutes in or get 20 minutes in and get kind of bored and then like turn it off. And then this happened like a few times in a row. And I thought like maybe I would actually like, very rarely do I not finish games. Like even if I hate it, I feel like I need to finish so that I can have like a true opinion. And eventually I ended up getting over that hump. And I don't know if that was the game or that was me, or maybe just playing late in the evening, a game with a lot of text was not the best match. But just saying that it wasn't something that I got immediately engrossed in, like from the start, like I had to kind of work at it. I kind of had to treat it almost like homework. Like, all right, Brian, try again tonight. See if you can actually like.
Probably worth mentioning that I felt that that wasn't a problem with like a game like Disco Elysium, where I think kind of hooks you pretty quickly.
Yeah. So the setting is, first of all, I think the title is kind of poor. Like the game does explain it, but it doesn't really mean much of anything. That's a personal opinion. It is a Disco Elysium like, and what I mean by that, to try not to be so obnoxious, is that it's like an isometric RPG that is very dialogue heavy, that has components of like adventure game aspects to it in terms of like, you meet a person, they give you some sort of task, you pick up items along the world. These items will unlock new dialogue if you bring them to certain people or if you have them, you know, equipped or in your inventory. There is like a time of day, and there's time passes throughout this game. So certain people are in certain places at certain times of day. The game takes place over the course of like just under a week. So on day one, certain people are at certain places. On day two or three, they might be in different places. So, and it's a sort of game where you cannot see or do everything. Like you will have to make decisions on, as you talk to people, time passes, you have to rest. So you can't just stay awake 24 hours for 5 days. So do you stay up super late and then sleep the next day and miss your opportunity to talk to people? So it's the sort of game where if like you're a completionist, which I kind of am sometimes, it ends up feeling like, oh, you're going to miss things. Like there are certain people that you will never meet or never talk to. Or you'll meet them like on day three when you could have talked to them and met them on day one. And it is a sort of game that is very heavily D&D inspired, not explicitly D&D, but your six stats are strength, dexterity, constitution, you know, charisma, wisdom, intelligence. You are a cleric and it treats it like the class cleric, as in like you have a god that you are in the school of and you know, have the ability to channel magic spells and things like that. The premise of the game is that you wake up and you have really no memory of where you came from. You're an amnesiac and you believe to have died, but you're clearly not dead. So it's like, did your god save you? Are you actually undead and you don't know it? The game kind of plays fast and loose with it. Like you thought you died, but you're still here. So don't worry about it. Clearly it's fine. It doesn't even really like answer the question succinctly. Like, did you just think you died, but were mistaken? Did someone revive you like with a resurrection spell? Are you just a zombie now? Don't worry about it. And that's kind of the tone that the game kind of has, is that I think one of the things I struggled with is that the game has a particular sense of humor that if you don't jive with it, it's hard to get around. And I find myself like chuckling a little bit, but a lot of the humor just really isn't my style. And it's the sort of thing where it's like, I can't grade that objectively or like substantiate it too much. Like I'm just not vibing with the humor here. So the way that this borrows from Disco Elysium, in Disco Elysium, you like speak to the voices in your head representing like the different, I'm trying to think of like mindsets. I forget what they call them in the game, but the different like aspirations that you have. In this game, it's a little just you speak to the concept of strength or of wisdom or of intelligence. The voices in your head are like assigned to one of those stats. And like how much you get along with them is determined by, you know, what your stat is or if you've got gear that boosts that stat. So like my character is really high wisdom, so me and wisdom get along really well, but I have pretty low strength. So strength, me and strength, oftentimes when I go to talk to him, it'll actually say like DC check failed. You don't understand what they mean or you can't continue this conversation. So that's kind of how it plays with the concept. You wake up and you're this is very much like a city block RPG, where it takes place over a relatively small but very dense play space where you're in a district of a city. I hope I get all the names right. The district of the town is called Tolstad. The city is called Norvik. But then it's like that city is located in a country and that country is located in a continent. That continent is located on a planet. Like it's almost, imagine that the creator of the game creates like this fantasy inspired, really richly built world. Like there's a lot of world building and you will read a lot about it, about its history, about the epochs of this world, about all the other places people come from or go to or all the other cities or, you know, histories. But you don't see any of that directly. Everything takes place in one district of one city. So that's something that I kind of struggled with a little bit in terms of, like, I've played plenty of games that are RPGs with a lot of reading or a lot of talking or a lot of world building. But the fact that you read about a lot of things that are happening or have happened off screen. So and it kind of comes at you really quick. So you almost kind of have to be in the mindset to be like, all right, I'm going to read this almost like a textbook to like try to put a piece together. OK, I've heard about this place before. Another character mentioned it. It's, I guess, south of here. Or, you know, you might have like a mental map in your head, or you might hear about, yeah, the halflings, they came from this place, or there was strife over from this other country. And that's kind of like the two ways that this game tells its story. There's the story about the few days that you're in the one small playable space that you're in. And then there's like the world building itself, which is like the more wide scale, longer reaching story that is kind of like all the context for everything else. The main context is that there is an election in, I believe, 5 days. And there are certain people in town that are pushing for certain different like ideologies. And this is where it also borrows from like Disco Elysium. So it's pretty overt about it. Like, it's not subtle. Like, there are certain people that call themselves free striders, and they're basically like ultra capitalists. There are certain people called Asgalists, and they're basically like socialists, or like, you know, that at least like social democrats, as we see in the United States. There are people that are very like fascist. There are people that are very like apolitical, but they're really like self-serving. And you kind of, the game, I haven't gotten to the end, so I can't really talk about, does the game have a thesis between these two? But it almost kind of, it plays all of these ideas to like their extreme end, for good or for ill. And I guess depending on the mindset of the player, some are more overt than others, in terms of like the people that are explicitly fascist are painted very villainously. The people that are more democratic free striders or socialist, it depends on where you're coming from, sort of thing, where it does paint the characters in a certain way, but it also has them like go to the extreme extent where kind of reason is thrown out the window. And the game kind of does this with that sense of humor that I talked about. The humor that this game does, both in like the dialogue that other characters respond to you or your choices that you get, I think it kind of comes in two flavors. Either you can just play your character like very stupid, in terms of like pretend your IQ is your IQ stat is very low, where you end up saying dumb statements like it's illegal to break the law. Like, it's like, of course it is, sir. Like, what are you trying to get at there? Or you can pretend to be on the political spectrum or the side of whoever you're talking to. Like, yeah, I promise I'm an ultranationalist. Now, please give me a quest. Or communism, I love that. Please give me, you know, let me help you, or sort of thing. And you don't need to be like politically consistent. And the game will kind of poke at you if you do that, if you're not consistent, but it allows you to be whatever. The game has some, like, most of the RPG mechanics are through dialogue, through like interacting with the world, in terms of like stealing items or sneaking into places you shouldn't be, or finding notes that you can give to people that either say like, wow, this company that works by the water lane has some shady book dealings. You could either give them to like the leader of this place, or you could give them to the communists so that they can blackmail the capitalists later. So that's kind of when I said it was like an adventure game, that it kind of depends on who you speak to, and also like what you have when you speak to them, or who you've met first versus who you met second. So it's a sort of game where I think it encourages replays, where you could end up like taking a completely different tact, having a completely different skill spread. There are certain places where it kind of cuts corners, and I'm not surprised by it, like in ways that I think make sense. For instance, I had one item that it said you could give this to faction A, but you could also give like this incriminating note to faction B. When I go to faction A, you kind of have a thought with yourself and you're like, should I give this to them? And they basically say like, nah, you really shouldn't. And then it kind of takes the option away from you, where it kind of teases you and says like, you have so many options available to you. But then when you try to execute some of them, it says like, actually, not really. Like, we didn't plan for that. But I can kind of understand that, because they have to kind of keep it constrained in some respects. There were certain times where the logic of the game kind of broke a little bit, because maybe I did things out of order in a way that the developers didn't intend or didn't plan for. So you do get like companion characters that join you. Like, you get like a little goblin companion named Snell. He's basically keeping tabs on you. You get a mimic that's like shaped like a cloak, and he's like, I'm not really a cloak, I'm a mimic, but I'll pretend to be a cloak if you want. So you wear him, and he's just like your mimic friend that, you know, lays across your shoulders, and it's like, okay, I guess I have a mimic with me now. But there were certain times where the game treated as if I had met a companion that I'd never met yet. Yeah. So just the logic didn't follow through, and that happens. Like, maybe the developers will suss those out and kind of either like reshape those dialogue trees to account for that, but it didn't really bother me. So I've talked about the story, I've talked about the gameplay. It does have some light combat, but the combat is usually more like this character is very imposing. Do you want to do a strength roll to see if you punch them successfully? And then based on your strength stat or what gear you have equipped, you basically, very, very like Baldur's Gate 3-esque, where you'll actually see like the dice roll take place. Then you'll see your bonuses applied or your advantage or disadvantage applied and see whether or not you succeed. And sometimes failure is just fine. It just progresses the quest in a different route. But sometimes failure literally is like, you died, reload a save. So it's kind of interesting in that sense, because part of me is like, well, I don't want to save scum too much, because sometimes I just kind of want to roll with the punches. But sometimes it's like, nope, you literally roll a dice that sees whether you live or die. And if you don't roll successfully, we will force you to load your save and try again, which is kind of interesting to be like, oh, I guess it's forced, like a forced dice roll that might end my character, which never felt good, because it felt like, well, I just died due to random chance. But the game does give you tools to like, okay, you could equip gear or items or cast spells. They give you a buff and a certain stat that you need in order to improve your chances of success. So that always feels, just fine. But it took me like 5 or 6 sessions to really kind of start jiving with the game. And now that I've actually like gotten over that hump and I understand, like I know the map layout, I know kind of where the characters are. The game kind of does like the Shin Megami Tensei thing, where certain characters are kind of like, what's the term you like to use, Adam? They basically serve as like the
like ciphers,
pigment that represents. Say that again.
Ciphers.
Yeah, like basically, like, oh, this character represents a certain ideology. Not every character is like that, but some are very clearly coded as like, oh, this one's like ultra nationalist, because they're asking for things that are very self-serving, or they have no respect or empathy for people that are not like them. So maybe I shouldn't treat them with any respect, and then you can be an asshole to them. But if you're an asshole to them, then you're not going to curry favor with them, which might cause you some issues in the future, but you don't know until you keep playing. And the game does, this sounds like a silly thing to like, to point out, but the game does have a lot of fun with like its achievements, where the achievements will encourage you to say like, say something nationalist 12 times, say something capitalist 18 times, pretend you're a wizard 6 times. So like, if you're going for achievements, it will force you to kind of do things and just kind of see where the story takes you, which it's one of those things where, is it a big component of the game? Not really, but it does actually encourage you in a small way to like, play the game and make decisions that maybe you wouldn't normally have made, which I always prefer that over like, just you get all the achievements by playing the story or something.
Disco
like
Elysium
that.
Is similar in its achievements, mm-hmm. and they've added a bunch, but I remember I played it when it launched and there was a handful of ones, and the ones that I had no one liked to get was like, make Kim Katsuragi sad.
That's actually like even hard to do, which is the thing that makes it sting all the more, because yeah. It's like that dude has gives you a lot of fucking rope to hang yourself with before he gets truly upset. Disappointed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I guess one aspect of the story I didn't really talk about, but it's like what the story is framed around, but the importance, it's hard for me to judge. So there was an explosion in a tea house, basically a little independent business that was just run by a single owner, that basically after you wake up and you have amnesia, you learn about, oh, there was an explosion, and you go there and you actually see like the wall is damaged and there's like char marks everywhere. And like the shooting in Disco Elysium, the murder and the hanged body, it kind of kicks off that story. The explosion at the tea house kind of kicks off the story of Esoteric Ebb. So it's important, but also like you can spend hours progressing the story in a way that doesn't directly impact the tea house. If that makes sense, like you're learning about where people came from, or, you know, what they're here for. Are they stuck in the town, or are they here for a greater purpose? You know, are they allies? Are they enemies? And eventually, like, yeah, it all kind of comes back to the tea house, but only in like subtle, small, smart ways. So I think it's a perfectly fine like way to like kick off the story and at least give you like an initial starting point for like, why are you even here? Like, what are you even motivated to do this for? So the motivation is basically figuring out, A, what happened to the tea house? And then the thing I haven't gotten to yet is at the end of the game, I presume, in the last day, there's the big election. And you can ask people the entire game, like, who are you voting for? I'm planning to vote for whatever. Like, and you can say, like, I'm going to be, you know, you can side with any of the factions, or you can say, like, I'm going to rule the city before all said and done. You know, it's kind of the more evil coded route, at least ostensibly. So I'm not sure, like, and I don't know for sure, but I'm presume like the way that you progress the quest throughout the game will somehow tilt the outcome of that election. But again, I don't know for sure. I guess the one thing I will say is that completing the quests, because you do have like a quest map, is how you primarily gain EXP. So like you do gain small amounts of EXP for like learning things or picking locks or stealing things or the small number of combat encounters, but primarily it's by completing quests. So in a very like Vampire the Masquerade 1-esque, like you are encouraged to just kind of learn things and do things and complete tasks and progress storylines. And that's primarily how you get stronger and get new gear. And the gear has like explicit, you know, if you hold on to this hammer, your constitution is +1, like at a base level. But also, like, if you hold on to this hammer, you might get advantage to D20 rolls that having a hammer is useful. So the game's kind of smart in that way, where it's like, oh, this hammer is useful because I'm trying to break open this glass case or whatever. Or this hammer is useful because I have a constitution check in dialogue here, and this gives me a bonus. So you're encouraged pretty frequently. And I love games that do this. There's no best in slot. There's like, oh, I'm trying to do this. Let me slot out my gear so that I have my best chance of success, whether it's through purely your stat rolls or because the gear is just well aligned to the goal that you're trying to do because it's a hammer and you're trying to break open a crate or whatever. So all of that is like the things I've enjoyed most about the games. The thing that I've struggled with most are, like I said, the rapid fire pace and volume of world building that you just kind of have to read through. There's no way around it. So that's something where it just kind of comes with the territory. And then the humor is very hit or miss. I find myself rolling my eyes more often than not. Humor. It's not really an objective statement about it being good or bad, just not for me, or doesn't align with my senses.
Era of humor are we talking about? Is it like, is it millennial humor, Gen Z humor?
Monty Python?
Kind of Monty Python-esque.
Okay.
Like the humor is, like I stated, either you play your character very dumb or you play him like very, very brash. Like imagine that you go to a bartender and then you say like, hey, can I sleep in your bed? Like that's like one of the options in the dialogue, and they're like, no, I hardly know you. And then the voices in your head will be like, she was off put by that, like way to go genius, or things like that. It's like, well, why was that even an dialogue option to begin with? So there are like, it's a sort of thing where if you don't want to be a dumb person or a very brash person, there are dialogue options that you don't have to select those. You can be more reasonable or analytical, but they're always there. And like every single dialogue tree, you can role play as either an idiot or someone who has a very high opinion of themselves. I guess that's kind of the two flavors, idiot or arrogant. And sometimes it is funny, but oftentimes I'm just like, okay, I guess. But just the writing style of the game. Yeah.
Okay, I thought there was more like in the script of like, are they going to throw out terms I don't know because I'm not in with the kids?
No, not like that.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. More just being like very thick-headed.
Got it.
But so I'm not going to do like a formal review, I don't think. I mean, maybe I will once I finish, I'm not sure. But it was something that I just kind of started poking at because of word of mouth on my Steam Deck late at night. And I've enjoyed my time with it. I want to make sure I make that clear. Just it took me a little bit to acclimate to it, I guess, is kind of the end of my thesis, is that I didn't take to it right away. And even now that I've gotten more into it, I'm not like enthralled by it, but it's something where I'm like, oh, okay, I see what they're doing. Okay, this is well done. Okay, I would have done this differently, but I see what they were going for. But having a decent time with it, and it definitely is unique. There's, you know, it has those comparisons that we've given, but they're kind of surface level at best. I think it's kind of doing a lot on its own. That's worth seeing for yourself if it sounds at all interesting. But yeah, just my two thoughts on Esoteric Ab being, I presume, I think like 2/3 of the way through it.
Before we move on, are we moving on?
No worries.
Yeah.
No, yeah, we're moving on.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, I did get my Steam controller at last this past week. I wanted to talk about like it kind of, it feels really good. Like I already like playing on this more than like my DualSense, PS5 DualSense. I think it's because it's lighter than that. It feels like, yeah, it's definitely lighter than that. And it's not what you think at first. Like everyone says like, oh, it's basically the Steam Deck, but without a screen. But the controller itself is like the ergonomics, at least for the size of my hand, feels nice. And the back buttons, like they stick out more than the Steam Deck, because the Steam Deck has the back buttons, but they're more in line with the device itself. Like they kind of are pushed in more, and the shape of those back buttons are like more rectangular, while the buttons on the Steam Deck or the Steam controller pop out more and are more like smaller circular ones. Like it's a nice feel, but it feels weird at first because the way that how I hold it, the tips of my ring and middle fingers are always covering over those back buttons. So like it's kind of a weird feeling at first because like it's like, will I accidentally press these back buttons or not? But I don't know. I haven't really accidentally pressed them that will fuck me up. Maybe I'll accidentally press them, but they're not bound to anything. And having the functionality of the dual touchpad is nice, like because there are some games that I play that do have like can only be navigated with like the mouse cursor. So that I've gotten really like used to like the touchpads because of the Steam Deck. So those feel like actually like really good. I really like just the overall texture and feeling of the controller, especially like moving around the sticks. Like the whatever they did with the sticks feels really like. It is also, it's like, it's just becoming like one of my favorite controllers to kind of just like hold, and like I feel like it's easy to play games for an extended amount of time with it, where with the DualSense I feel like it's kind of on the heavier side. Not to say that's like it's hard to lift up, but like over time, like for me, it just becomes increasingly uncomfortable to play on a DualSense compared to the Steam Deck controller. Or Steam controller.
I don't have the technical like vocabulary to speak to it, but I remember seeing something like, "Does the controller have Hall Effect sticks?" Like, no, it has something better called
PMR or whatever, something.
Yeah, and I don't know what that means, but like apparently maybe what the technology behind how they function with the actual components of the controller is.
Yeah, I don't know. I recommend people watching the Gamers Nexus breakdown of the Steam controller, because they actually talk about like the technology behind what's in these sticks and the Hall Effect. Like they show like the difference in it, have a very good like visual of it. Not to say that like you'll understand it even when it's visualized, but it's like, okay, I sort of understand like what differentiates them. But obviously, you know, there's a lot of like scientific lingo that like, you know, it kind of goes over my head, but I'm sure Adam will understand. I have faith in that.
I literally do Hall Effect like semiconductor analysis on a daily basis.
So there you go.
You apply a magnet and the carriers move and you can make deductions from that.
Nerd.
See, Adam understands how magnets works on like 95% of the world's population.
But it creates a voltage that you can measure.
How heavy is the controller? Because I actually like my controllers to have a little bit of heft to them. Like the Nintendo Switch 2 Pro controller, I really like, except that it's too light.
It
that's
is.
A silly question, but how heavy is the Steam controller?
How do I? It is about.
Does it have heft?
It's about like if you have the Switch 2 Pro controller, it's like almost the same weight as that. It's,
oh, okay.
Yeah. So like that. Okay. Not that I'm holding both of them, it's like. Maybe it's like a tiny bit heavier than Switch 2 Pro controller.
All right, sounds perfect.
So that's how I'm gonna. I'm sure that's very helpful to people.
1.2 Switch controllers, anything but the metric system.
Yeah,
but
I think the first time set of it, because the primary use of this is for my Steam Deck. This is not gonna replace my day to day like. Desktop controller. I'm still using my DualShock 4 for that because there are a good number of games I play outside of Steam, and I know that the Steam controller can still work on games outside of Steam. But it's to a limited effect. Like I think some people, it's like a hit or miss for some people. Like I know One of our alumni, Zach, I've been talking to him here and there about the Steam controller. And like, he's like, for Arknights Enfield, for example, that he plays, like, I think natively he can't, like, the Steam controller doesn't work on it, but when he adds it onto Steam, and he has to like run Steam in administrator mode, it'll pick it up. It's so, it's like one of those things where like it takes like one too many steps to get like this thing maybe working for a non-native Steam game that way. So that's why I'd rather just keep it on my Steam and like my primary desktop. I'm eventually gonna get this new GameSir controller in, whatever. I have it pre-ordered. I just don't know when they're gonna start shipping it. But hopefully that'll like be the one that's like, hey, I'm gonna stick with this as my primary on my desktop. But I don't know what I was expecting. I guess I didn't do much research on this, but when I took it out of the box and to try to hook it up on my Steam Deck the first time, you can't. It's hard to do it because I don't have a Steam Deck dock. And I was like, how do I hook this up with the puck, with the Steam controller puck, if I don't have the dock? Because the cable that they provide you to do this with the puck is a USB-C to A cable, but there's no USB-A slots on the deck itself on that. So they expect you to use it with a dock, but I'm like, I don't have a dock. So eventually I was like, do I need to like get some sort of like USB-C to A adapter to hook up on my deck? I'm like, this kind of sucks. But like eventually I was like, you know, I know there's like a Bluetooth functionality on it, and hooking it up via Bluetooth was just fine. I know it's technically more latency on the button presses compared to the puck. I'm like, it's acceptable. I'm fine with it. It's okay, actually. So so right now I'm like using the Steam Deck or the Steam controller without the puck, just Bluetooth. That's for my daily usage on it. It's fine. I can still play games the response time is like, for to me, not really that noticeable. Still, I'm able to play like Gradius just fine. Never missed ever.
I mean, that's interesting. I have the Steam Deck dock, but I've never really used it because certain TVs don't read the input without like messing with like your source input like parameters. It was very it wasn't plug and play, is kind of what I'm getting at. Like, I'm sure you can make it work if you dig into it, maybe for both the Steam Deck dock on my TV or for you trying to get that to connect with the puck without USB-A to C converter of some sort. But it's, yeah, it seems like a little bit disappointing that there wasn't a clear method just out of the box to do it.
Yeah, thankfully, after you get it paired up via Bluetooth, the controller and the deck, it still needs to update your controller. But thankfully, that can just be done with a normal USB-C cable, the C head on both ends. So that didn't need any other unconventional cable on that. But yeah, it's like. Obviously, this might be on me because I didn't research it, and I was just like, I was like, it should be straightforward, right? And it's like, it's definitely not straightforward if you have the wrong, I guess, mindset or and don't have the dock with you. Okay, for sure. So I was a tiny bit disappointed, within the first 20 minutes until I just paired it up with Bluetooth, figured out that's fine. That's fine. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, I'm glad that I got it. I guess I might just bring it with me when I go down to California SGF, when they're just shooting the shit at the hotel room. Maybe I'll just play. I'd rather play my games with this controller than lifting up the deck and using the controls on the deck itself, because the deck's pretty heavy and it's uncomfortable to play that for an extended amount of time if you're lifting it up. Not to say that like I said, it's not super heavy, but over time when you're playing it for more than an hour or so, kind of gets to you. So I'd rather just have it, set it down, have the controller, and it feels good.
Mikhail, are you still awake?
Yes, I am.
You're up. All right. Middle of the night for you. So yeah, Mikhail, we're going on to features up on the site that we have this week, and you have two of them. One of them is about Hollow Knight, Mina the Hollower, and you had a chance to speak to Yacht Club Games, Sean Velasco, about their, you know, we've talked about Mina the Hollower, you know, in a few different contexts over its final eventual announcement of its release date coming out next week. So just kind of give us the rundown about your chance to speak with Sean over at Yacht Club.
Yeah, so this was originally going to happen last year, but the game got delayed multiple times, and I was kind of slightly annoying about it, so I finally got the interview done like I get with almost everything.
Sometimes you gotta be a little bit of a pest.
Yeah. A wise man once said that on this podcast. Mm-hmm. So, like I reached out to them and said, now that we have a release date and everything, can we do this? I know it's a busy season and stuff, and they were up for it. I think they've been doing quite a few like previews and interviews and all, so I could send them over a few questions. And like I say a few questions, but usually when I get told this, I just like think of whatever I can. I think I send them like 22 or 23 questions or whatever, and Sean answered everything. Like I even asked him some stuff about his career before that, because he's worked on quite a few old games before joining Yacht Club and stuff like that. So as for Mina the Hollower, I was curious about how they landed up on the price point, because it's $19.99 US when it releases at the end of this month. And I've seen like universal praise for it and also confusion as to why it's quote unquote too cheap. So I was curious about that. He explained that they basically want to move units, and they realize that the world is not in a great place right now, so they want to make sure it's affordable for more people. And then I was talking about the difficulty, because the demo which I played was quite difficult. It was like kind of felt like Shovel Knight. So he did mention that they have modifiers, and after the interview was published, they posted on their socials this long video showing like I think 50 different modifiers to like tweak the experience to make it harder or easier. And then Shovel Knight got like a shitload of spin-offs and like updates, which were all given for free to people who bought the game originally. And like I think it ballooned into this $40 or like $25 purchase from like $15. But then they also sold that stuff separately. So if you actually buy Shovel Knight right now, there are like 7 different games on Steam. There's like Shovel Knight Dig, Shovel Knight Pocket Dungeon, then there's Shovel Knight Spectre of Torment, King of Cards, all these spin-offs and all together. So I was curious whether they were going to do that with Mina the Hollower as well. And he just basically said that no, this is a complete, like a finished game, a complete project. We don't intend to do any DLC and stuff like that. And yeah, you can read the interview on the site. I asked about like accessibility, I asked about color palettes, because Mina the Hollower is like a Game Boy Color inspired thing, where they are kind of living in that restriction, like how with Shovel Knight they were doing the 8-bit thing. So the only difference over here is they are doing a widescreen thing, because Game Boy Color games were obviously not widescreen. And asked a bit about the soundtrack, stuff like that, what to expect from New Game Plus. And he said that there are 7 different New Game Plus versions where they have modifiers which are added. And I'm curious to see how that happens, like when more players get to it. And I think this will be like a speedrunner's dream or nightmare, depending on how they handle the New Game Plus. And yeah, that's like, read the interview if you're curious. I asked a bit about handheld stuff, but since there was a demo, there wasn't really much to talk about on the technical aspects. So yeah, very happy with how it turned out, and like finally being able to do it, because I feel like I was emailing about this maybe 12 months ago or something. So very happy it finally got done. So that was the first feature for the week.
Yep. So the interview said that I want to ask you about this. And it's what you pulled out as the title. If Shovel Knight is our Mario, Mina would become our Zelda. What did Sean mean by that?
Yeah. So, I when I was looking at what to quote for the title, I knew this would be the best one to do it, even though it's kind of boring, but whatever, it worked. So basically, when I was watching some prior interviews they've done, like not just Sean, Yacht Club in general, it kind of felt like Mina was just like a side project which ballooned into something massive. But he corrected me over there and said that no, they were always intending to do like 2 different things, and they treat them both very important. So it's not like Mina is just some small IP or something, like it's as important as Shovel Knight. So that's why they said if Shovel Knight is our Mario, Mina is our Zelda, like both are top tier or prestige things for them. And then like I've seen people quote that and say, but isn't Shovel Knight more like Mega Man? But yeah, read the interview for context. So that's what happened with that. And I believe they have said in another interview somewhere else that they also want to have their Metroid. So that's going to be interesting if they do like a third pillar or whatever, where they do like a literally a full Metroidvania or something. So
yeah,
but yeah, he's pretty candid on like them wanting, like he just said that you haven't heard the last of Mina, brackets, like as long as it sells LOL or laughs. And also they are pretty candid about wanting to sell as much as they can with this. It's not like a foregone conclusion that it's going to be like some multi-million selling game. So we'll see how it does for them when it comes out later this month. Go ahead, yep. James.
I was just going to say, I have seen those people you're talking about. They're like, well, wasn't Shovel Knight more of a Mega Man game? Why are you saying that it's a Mario to this game Zelda? It's like, they're not talking about the actual gameplay. They're talking about in terms of IP. How is that so hard for people to understand?
They didn't read it, the interview. That they just read the headline.
Also, it's like, that's from the developer. It's not like Mikhail put that in their mouth. Like.
Oh, I mean, like, it's funny that you brought that up, because when I did the, just 1 second, let me get the exact quote so I'm not messing this up, because someone got mad at me in another Discord server for, it was from the Honkai Star Rail interview, where I know that the producer is a huge Trails fan. Like, they've had interviews with Kondo from Falcom, like back and forth. So when I brought up, do you want to do a Trails collaboration with the dev team, and they didn't mention Trails, but they just said that we have, like, they gave me a generic answer, and then people online were like, oh, he didn't mention Trails anyway, you just put that into link bait us and all. And I'm like, well, I literally asked them the question, so
what are you gonna do? People are always gonna be like this. It's fine. I but obviously, you know, this is gonna be, Mina is an extremely important game for Yacht Club games. I mean, it's been well documented that, like, their future is, they're staking their future on how well this game does. So, good luck. It's nail-biting in a lot of aspects.
And the second feature that you have really more is an evergreen written feature for the site. But maybe you can pull out some key takeaways for the podcast format. You have a list, and you have a couple of these, but you have an explicit list for best RPGs to play on PS5 Pro, and you've got a fairly long list here. But like, I'm just curious, as you're putting this list together, were there like really key, like surprising entries that really shine on PS5 Pro compared to
PS5 when standard or PC? I started doing this, I thought, like when I pitched it to Alex, I was like, you know, I'll just do this as another evergreen, and yeah, he's always cool for that. So I started putting it together and then slowly adding more games to the thing. And when I started actually doing my notes, because I've been like, I literally ran through my data cap twice that month, because games are big now, and I think I downloaded 8 terabytes in that 1 month of games just to test. So when I ended up putting it together and I shared it with a friend of mine, he's like, this is like way too big, you should have like cut it down to just 10 games or whatever. I was like, no, I'm gonna do everything. So they are basically, this stemmed from when I just picked up the PS5 Pro, because like Sony finally fixed their upscaling, the PSSR2, which is there, like it's a collab with AMD, their upscaling, which is like, I don't know if it's, you call it proprietary or whatever, but it's kind of like a team project for AMD and Sony. So when they fixed that and when they announced the price was going up, I was like, okay, these are like two things happening now. Let me just finish it off and get that. So I'd say most of the games, like there are too many to list to talk about, but most of them have like dramatic improvements over base PS5, just in like mainly in visuals, because a lot of developers have started relying on upscaling quite heavily this gen on everything. Like we've seen that with even games you wouldn't think are heavy, like that Lego Batman game coming in a few days, like when they released their system spec, the low spec says 30 FPS with frame generation and upscaling. That's kind of insane to even put that out. Like,
yeah.
You're just saying your game runs like shit in general to me when I see that. So because upscaling has now become like a crutch or something that like everyone's just, you know, like Unreal Engine games in general, you usually have to run them very low and then rely on the upscaling. Josh spoke about this with Wu Chang Fallen Feathers, because I remember like both of us were talking about it, and whatever you do, it still looked like it was being upscaled, and they had to fix that, and there was like this whole thing with the updates. But yeah, like to cut that short, Sony fixed their upscaling. A lot of games which, you usually would have to choose between quality mode or at 30 FPS or performance mode at 60 FPS with like worse visuals. You basically get both together on PS5 Pro in many of the games. The biggest one, which I think everyone knows, is like Rebirth, because it looks like dog shit in the performance mode on base PS5. And now it actually looks really, really nice. It doesn't fix all the issues, because neither does the PC port, unless you do like INI editing for the Unreal Engine config file. But Rebirth is finally, it does not give me motion sickness now when I play it at 60 FPS. So that's like a nice win. Other than that, like Assassin's Creed Shadow is always a really good looking game. It was one of those games where if you played in performance mode on PS5, or if you play on like Switch or Switch 2 or Series S, it just disabled ray tracing. And that game was built for ray tracing. So when you have like a poor lighting solution, it just looks flat. So now on PS5 Pro, you get both together. You get 60 or 40 FPS and you have ray tracing. There's also like a few games which didn't do much on PS5 Pro were like Avowed and The Outer Worlds 2. Both of these Unreal Engine 5 games, they kind of just are higher resolution with some tweaks to lighting. Not massive upgrades like, you know, like Baldur's Gate 3, now you can play 60 FPS in split screen, or just games like that. Even Expedition 33, like a massive clarity boost. And I don't even play at 4K, I play at 1440p. And I could tell Expedition 33 was a massive upgrade. I think the biggest one which I'd recommend people check out is Cyberpunk 2077. I feel like this is going to be like a tech showcase game for any hardware for a long time now, because they even did like a amazing Mac port which like has ray tracing on like MacBook Pros and stuff like that. So yeah, I'll just give two quick shout outs. Dynasty Warriors Origins, already a super polished and amazing looking game, much better on PS5 Pro with how it looks visually. And one game which I've been slowly chipping away, like two games actually which I've been chipping away for a long time, Inazuma 11 Victory Road. It's like 4K 120 FPS on PS5 Pro. And Kingdom Come Deliverance 2. I thought that game looked fantastic in general, but it's like one of the best looking games I've seen now when I play it on PS5 Pro. So yeah, I'd recommend reading the article. I've covered basically every single game except for I think 4 which have PS5 Pro support. And I also covered just PS5 games which run better in general on PS5 Pro. One of them is Metaphor: ReFantazio, poorly optimized game. It actually is the only way to get 60 FPS on console now if you play on PS5 Pro locked. So that's funny.
Pour one out for Mikhail's data cap and your hard drives. So, but no, thank you. I know it's a lot of work to put all those listicles together. And yeah, really, really more of an evergreen to put on the site, but just kind of a good thing to reference, you know, for anyone who has or is planning to upgrade to a PS5 Pro, which ones are definitely going to see the most bang for their buck for in terms of improved either visual clarity or performance. So it sounds like Cyberpunk, Kingdom Come, Rebirth, and a few others like Inazuma 11. With that, we'll go into news, kind of a quieter news slate here this week. No real major announcements. We do have a few trailers and a few like release dates and sales and, you know, the usual kind of bit news to talk about. I do have a listing here about the moving date for the new Legend of Zelda live action film. So it got moved up to an April date next year rather than May. Josh, you wrote in here, this is Miyamoto, based on how it was announced.
So, I mean, this just becomes like an ongoing joke now of like anytime Nintendo has to like convey a message from Miyamoto, they always they don't go like Miyamoto here, or like, you know, hey, you know, anything like that. It has to be very like a very strict like tone of like, this is Miyamoto, and then whatever the fucking message has to be. It's like, it's so funny. I crack up every time that they have to say "this is Miyamoto" for that messaging. But yeah, it's a very small tidbit of like the live action Legend of Zelda movie coming next year. I think it was coming out. I forgot the original release date, but then they pushed it back to May 7th, and now they're moving it back up to April 30th next year. So that's really it.
In general, I'm not a huge movie buff, but it is interesting to me when like you see like the big Star Wars or Marvel or whatever announcements, and they're like, this film will release on April 23rd, 2029. I'm like, how likely is that to not move? Like, it just seems like they nail down a date for like so far out that they're gonna have to just move later. And this is the Zelda movie in specific is just next year, but they seem to try to get their slate really ironed out for like theater release and all that other stuff. So
I don't know what to expect out of that movie, to be honest. I have no idea.
Okay, in terms of upcoming trailers for some upcoming games, this is one that I would definitely lean very strongly on Chow if he was here, but Josh, maybe you know these characters. The Granblue Fantasy Relink Endless Ragnarok has announced two new playable characters in addition to the ones we talked about last week. I'm just going to pronounce these how they're spelled. Frau and Fedil.
Fedil, yep. Got it.
All right.
Yeah, this was interesting because this was sort of leaked beforehand where I think it was a Korean outlet, like a merchandise, advertising, like incoming merchandise for Endless Ragnarok. And like people noticed like, hey, there's like two characters on that like at the time weren't revealed for the game. It's like, are these characters coming? And sure enough, like a few days later, they announced the second trailer and that went up and they did reveal Frau and Fedil as playable. And that's really, it's exciting for the Granblue community because I think a lot of people, you know, people like the Relink roster, but it was very dated in terms of like, hey, these characters, especially like the main crew, you know, they don't really represent like the current, the popular characters in Granblue at the moment. And it seems like, at least for one of my friends, especially Frau was their favorite out of this group called the Invokers, I believe. But they just never imagined that Frau would be the character from the Invokers that would be selected to be playable in this game. And they're very excited. It seems like Frau has a very dedicated following from the game. And Fedil is, I think, from like the Sixth Dragon, Great Dragon Generals or whatever. Granblue people, I don't really know Granblue. I'm going off of hearsay from like friends that I speak with that know it better. So if I'm getting things wrong, feel free to burn me on that end. She's been very popular in Granblue for several years now, ever since her debut especially from her character design is very, you know, very popular amongst that player base, but she seems to have like a fun personality too. So people are mega excited that they were able to come over to Relink. And also one of the most popular bosses in Granblue history, the world, which, you know, from I guess there's like a tarot card, a story in Granblue that people refer to as the Arcanum. I don't know exactly what that entails, but apparently that storyline or parts of that storyline are being represented in Relink, and one of the most popular bosses in Granblue history with the world. Like the world is like the tarot card, and like I guess the visualization of that tarot card inside the game will be like, you know, one of the big boss battles in this Endless Ragnarok expansion, which people are excited about because I guess like the world has like a really interesting mechanics inside that game, and they're interested to see how that is represented in Relink, much like how Lucilius was added to Relink in some post-launch update. And he had a very unique mechanic called like the 12 labors. So throughout that fight, that boss fight in Relink, you have to do a lot of like different things throughout that boss fight that centers on this labors mechanic in that regard. So they also had a separate trailer that went up that showed more of the summons and the roguelite system. And one of the big takeaways from this other new trailer was that playable summons like Lucilius will be a playable summon in the game, and that's a huge deal because Lucilius is giga popular, especially in Japan in the Granblue community. So a lot of people are very, very, very excited that, you know, even though you'll be able to play Lucilius in a limited capacity, like even the Lucilius being playable at all is very seems to have a lot of the Granblue community very excited. I guess the one downer is Roland, one of the new characters introduced in Relink, will be playable as a summon as well. So Roland is not a full-fledged playable character, but will be playable as a summon in Endless Ragnarok. And there's some other characters like the order that Macliel is from, like the hooded characters, will be summons as well. So, you know, that's kind of the other part of the announcement. It's like, hey, that's there's seems to be a lot packed in this game that they're holding out on. So everything's been looking really, really good for this game. I actually reinstalled Relink yesterday to get prepared for it because I haven't unlocked the Eternals, Seofon and Tuyen, and Sandalphon, who were both these three characters were added as post-launch updates to the game, and I didn't get around to playing them. And you kind of have to grind for them, though you can always pay up and get like easy unlocks for them as well. But I was like, I'll do the grind for Seofon and Tuyen. Sandalphon, I don't know. Sandalphon seems to be a giga grind because you have to farm the Lucilius boss fight, and that's a really, really hard fight to continually do. I don't know yet if I'll just pay up for Sandalphon or not. But I'm, you know, it's the release date for this expansion is it's getting nearer and nearer. It's like early July, I believe. And I've only become more and more excited ever since its announcement, and I can't wait. Everything they've been revealing so far is like really, really cool.
Adam, are you up to date on the grind?
No.
You're like, no. So we have those trailers put together in our news post up on the site. Another late May release, Zero Parades for Dead Spies from Adam, you told us how to pronounce this, but I forget.
It's just Zum? A single syllable. It's like Zum.
Zum. All right. So this is an interesting, it's a longer like video. They call it a developer showcase. It's kind of like a mishmash of different things. Like it starts with like a music video. Then it's like an interesting like fashion collab, or at least like some sort of like physical collab of some sort. And then it goes into like a deep dive where different developers in different roles on the game talk about different aspects of it in terms of like, here's a small quest, here's some dialogue, here's some options you have, here are the things we can do. Then it has like a teaser for like a tabletop game or a pen and paper like version of the game. So it's kind of like an interesting like series of sub trailers for Zero Parades. An interesting one, I was actually just talking to Adam right before the podcast here. I'm like, man, this game looks fun, but it's hard to divorce it from everything that has gone on in the studio that we've already talked about in terms of the ousting of the writing team from Disco Elysium since that game's released 5 years ago or 6 years ago. So I do think it was a good look to actually have like the different development roles talking to the different aspects of the game, but you can never quite fully decouple those two, you know, those two situations. We also got a trailer for the upcoming Experience dungeon RPG, Demon Kill Demon, Yomi 1984. This is like the follow-up or successor, not necessarily a sequel to Labyrinth of Yomi.
They say it's a sequel.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I remember. Okay, I'll just call it sequel then. A demo is coming to Japan in just a few days. I don't know if we'll see it in the West. They haven't said anything, but the trailer primarily is like character art and an introduction, but also just the announcement of the upcoming demo. And then the game itself releases in Japan just shortly thereafter before the end of the month, but see if we'll get any sort of localization or worldwide release announcement, once it launches in Japan.
I completely forgot this was a thing in Japan for the first game, but apparently they're doing it again here too. The physical release has both the main game and the post game. The digital release is two separate things, where you can just buy the main game if you don't intend to do the post game, and then buy the post game later. I forgot they did that for Undernauts until I was reading the Japanese website, because I was like, I wonder how much it's going to cost digitally. It's like, wait a second. Wait, I remember this.
Oh, that is interesting. But it must have worked for them, or they wouldn't be doing it again. So,
yeah.
All right. There were a few smaller gamer announcements that we'll touch on here. There's a few Steam pages that Kite wrote up about that we'll touch on later. But this one had an announcement trailer. indie RPG called Echoes of the Flame. Very obviously inspired by like Square Enix HD2D offering, specifically Octopath. So we have the announcement trailer for Echoes of the Flame, which is going to be releasing on PC later this year in Japan and slated to release next year in the West. Now, just do want to very clearly note that the Steam page does clearly mark that generative AI was used to create image assets, character portraits, enemies, and UI. So there is that. They do tell you that they touch up all animations before implementation, but they just explicitly state that they use generative AI in the makings of Echoes of the Flame.
You know, I guess it is definitely worth mentioning, and you know, like generative AI is seen more favorably at like some other territories, like definitely scrutinized, rightly so, in the West. But there are other territories that are more, you know, integrated, accepted. It's one of those things like you kind of have to hash out the difference and see that like there are different perspectives on this usage of the technology throughout other parts of the world.
So yeah, for better or worse, it is very much. Way more accepted in Asia, like generally.
Yeah. It's not like, hey, don't go shit-flinging this solo developer because they're trying their best in their own way too.
Well, I was only bringing it up just for candidness. Yeah.
I know.
That was the only intent. Yeah,
it was more of like, you know, for people out there. If you don't want to support the game, totally fine. I understand. Yeah. I won't call out the name of the game because I forgot, but we did get a funny email several days ago. And Adam, you have to remind me exactly, but like there was this game that apparently had like over 100 or something tracks in its music that was like used generative AI in it. And I guess they're going to push out an update to gradually phase out the generated AI tracks in this game with real musicians, I guess, after getting feedback of it, if I have that right, Adam, right?
Yeah, I don't really know anything about this game other than that email I saw that you referred to. But it was like they made like a soundtrack of like, I don't know, hundreds of AI songs. And they're like, we heard you. We're going to change these to like songs made by real people. Thanks to feedback. And it's like,
what are we doing? That one is like, okay, that's absurd. Like you have hundreds of music generated AI and only through like, now you're going back and quote unquote fixing that from the feedback that you got. It's like maybe this was not a good idea. It's like, really thought about this one, did you?
In terms of just game updates, these aren't explicitly trailers, but just some quick updates to roll through. The Trails in the Sky second chapter, of course, releasing in September, September 17th worldwide. The website updated with a few just new gameplay tweaks, the sequel. And I forget if these were in SC or not, or how the specific gameplay changed for the
original games. No, these are SC.
These are new? All right.
Yeah.
They talk about Brave Rush. You can use two Brave Gauge points to activate, you know, dual attacks of some sort. And Enforcer Boost, they used right by the many boss fights throughout the game. So very quick little touch on just some new mechanics in the sequel. Blades of Fire, which is a game that James reviewed last year, had its kind of 2.0/Steam launch over the last week because it was EGS exclusive on PC before. So the update and the patch notes for what they added, new game plus, new difficulty level, Steam launch, Steam Deck compatibility, released just a few days ago on May 14th. So we have the details of those updates up on the site. A quick touch in at Shift Up and Stellar Blade. They are hard at work on the sequel. The next Stellar Blade title is going to be self-published. And they are currently still, no hard details, but still evaluating their platform strategy. Of course, Stellar Blade is originally released on PS5 and just came to PC like a little bit delayed on those two platforms right now. So not sure if they're talking about potential new platforms for Stellar Blade or for its follow-up, but they're just something they're still actively investigating.
I imagine the next one will be launching a PC simultaneous to a console launch, if anything. So now they don't have to, you know, since they're self-publishing, they pretty much have complete control over, like, you know, how they're going to market this game and their, like, distribution strategy. And obviously, you know, they get to dictate their own internal deadlines instead of working with Sony on that end, which, hey, good on them for like being successful enough with that title to be able to do this. Like, they have pretty much complete freedom over their own destiny now.
Mm-hmm.
A couple quick sales updates. Windrose, how do you describe this? The sandboxy, survival-y open world pirate game in early access has sold 2 million copies since its release in about a month ago in April. And then the Cyber Sleuth series, Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth, so that's the original in Hacker's Memory, has shipped over 3 million copies combined. The last time we heard, it was 1.5 million back in 2020. So just some steady legs on those two Digimon titles.
Yeah, kind of surprising, but I guess maybe more people picked it up after Time Stranger. You know, they were curious, like, hey, I want more.
I mean, like, you know, we had Time Stranger, we had like the reboot anime series, and then the Beat Break anime series. So it just seems like it's more in vogue mid 2020s than it was maybe in 2020.
That's Beat Break's pretty good, Dan. I've been continually watching it, and it's actually a pretty awesome show. I like it a lot.
And then the last two things we have here are. I'm not exactly sure how Kite found these. Maybe I'll ask him in the chat. But these are our new Steam pages for upcoming games from Japanese, I believe, developers. The first one is Immortal Wayfarer from Yifeng Studio. It looks like it is a game that is kind of Shirin or Mystery Dungeon coded roguelike. So no trailer, but we have like the description and the gameplay discussion and the screenshots available from the Steam page. And we kind of just kind of put them together into a news post up on the site. I don't think there's a slated release window, but just, you know, I got the store page all listed for it.
I think Kite and I like follow very similar like Japanese outlets because like definitely like me and him usually seem to spot like like similar Japanese indie titles, and it's usually reported on by several Japanese outlets on that end. And sometimes Automaton as well is a decent outlet for like discovering these more niche titles.
And then the other Steam page that he wrote about is for Star Shard Brigands. Got a Steam page for it as well. I didn't see what this one was more akin to. I guess it's a first person dungeon crawler also. This one does also. One second. I thought this one had an AI admonishment on it as well. Yes, it includes an AI tool usage for assets, though they do edit the assets. So kind of similar to Echoes of the Flame, but this one's just a first person dungeon crawler. This one does have a release window of 2027, and then just like Immortal Wayfarers, it does have a collection of screenshots and some descriptions from the store listing. So there's a couple like indie Japanese RPGs that we will just keep an eye on throughout 2026 and beyond.
And I guess just like, you know, also a heads up, like it's on the radar now, like within 2 weeks, I guess SGF is going to be Summer Games Fest be happening.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what we had for this episode of the podcast. So I'm looking at the dates. I'm looking at next week. Looks like we'll be talking about, let me check here. I guess Mina the Hollower, potentially. So thank you, Josh, for going over your thoughts on Starbites. And thank you, myself, for going over some initial thoughts on Esoteric Ebb. So the Starbites thoughts are up on the site, rpgsite.net. We also do have the Mina the Hollower interview from Mikhail with Yacht Club Games up on rpgsite.net as well. Join the Discord, discord.gg/RPGsite. Search for RPG Site on any of the social media networks, RPG Space Site, and you should be able to find us. If you listen to this podcast, leave us a like, leave us a rating. We'd love to see those. And until you hear from us next week, stay safe, take care, and we'll talk to you all next time.